on it. Just ask Miss Jeremiah still there.
Okay, Miss Jeremiah, are you still there? Miss Jeremiah? Hello? Okay. Okay, she's there.
Miss Carol.
Miss Moranich? Okay.
Miss Price.
Miss Price.
And Mr. Wilson.
Okay, Mr. Wilson.
It's really close.
Is that all? Okay, I'll ask about it.
And just ask them to mute their phone.
Okay, please, everyone, mute your phone.
Okay. I'll just hang it up.
Okay, what she said was that the first person that came on was clear, but after that it was very hard to hear. So she asked if the mic could be moved.
They do all the talking from up there? They do all the talking from up there?
To talk to Ed.
She's going to deliver.
Yeah. They're saying that after the first person was called, they can't hear.
They can't hear?
No.
She said the first person that came was they could hear well, but after the first person, they couldn't hear that well. This
after
one
the
person.
First,
said,
just one person. Okay.
Yeah.
And the rest can't hear that?
Well, I didn't ask them. She just mentioned it. I didn't ask. She just.
Okay.
Well, hopefully that'll help a little bit.
It's all the way up.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll just leave it here.
Okay.
We'll go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session, October 17, 2012, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus Black Castle Mining Company, docket numbers WEVA 2007-288 and WEVA 2006-891-R, and Secretary of Labor versus Michael Vera, employed by Black Castle Mining Company, docket number WEVA 2007-421. Present are myself, Chairman Jordan, Commissioner Young, and Commissioner Nakamura. We will start with an overview of the case presented by Anya Baez. And welcome, Anya. I know this is your maiden voyage time presenting a case to us, so hopefully it won't be too traumatic. Good morning, and go ahead, Anya.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Good morning. These consolidated cases are before the Commission pursuant to the Secretary of Labor's petition for discretionary review of the judge's decision, concluding that a violation did not occur. Black Castle operates a large surface coal mine in Boone County, West Virginia. On February 1, 2006, Paul Moss was fatally injured when the bulldozer he was operating contacted and ruptured a 16-inch natural gas line, which burst into flames. Moss was in the process of creating an access road from the Judy Low Gap area to the Clarion coal seam, where he was to construct a drill bench to allow drilling equipment to be brought to the site to start a new high wall. Pursuant to his accident investigation, MSHA Inspector James Humphrey issued a citation to Black Castle, alleging a violation of 30 CFR section 77.1713A. Michael Vera, an employee of Black Castle, was personally charged with the same violation under Section 110C of the Mine Act. Section 77.1713A requires in pertinent part that at least once during each working shift, or more often if necessary for safety, each active working area shall be examined for hazardous conditions, and any hazardous conditions noted during such examinations shall be reported to the operator and shall be corrected by the operator. For the purposes of his decision, the judge assumed that the accident site was a part of the active working area, where Black Castle and Vera were required to conduct an adequate on-shift examination. The judge further determined that it was not surprising that prior to the accident, the gas line was not perceived as a hazardous condition necessary to report on daily examinations, because the gas line had been present on the mine for at least the last 10 years. It was marked by a mowed or muddy right-of-way edged by trees, and everyone at the mine were aware of it. Therefore, the judge found that the pre-shift and on-shift examinations conducted by Vera were adequate and did not violate Section 77.1713A. Moreover, the judge concluded that the secretary has not proven that Moss had expressed considerable concern about the location of the gas line so as to subsequently put Black Castle or Vera on notice that the pipeline could be a hazardous condition. The secretary argues that the judge erred by shifting the responsibility for preventing unsafe conditions from the mine operator to the miner. The secretary maintains that the judge committed a fundamental legal error by absolving the mine operator of its responsibility to provide a safe workplace on the ground that the miner did not do enough to get the operator to perform its responsibility. In response, Black Castle maintains that the judge correctly held MSHA to its burden of proving that Black Castle had any reason to believe that the gas line needed to be marked any better than it was. Moreover, Black Castle asserts its employees took Moss on two trips to show him the location of the right-of-way in person. The secretary further argues that the judge erred by failing to adequately address relevant evidence regarding his finding that the location of the pipeline was known. The consensus of the witnesses was that although the general location of the pipeline was known, the exact location was unknown. The secretary maintains that the judge failed to recognize that Moss had not previously worked in this section of the mine and that this operation was a virgin one in the area. Black Castle argues that while the precise location of the pipeline within the 30 to 40 feet wide right-of-way could not be reliably identified short of digging up the pipeline, all the witnesses were aware of the location of the right-of-way. Therefore, Black Castle maintains that when Moss was instructed to stay 100 feet away from the pipeline, he should have stayed 100 feet away from the right-of-way. The secretary maintains that in finding that the gas line was marked by a mowed or muddy right-of-way edged by trees, the judge failed to address the fact that the closest marker was between 200 and 300 feet away from the accident site, that Black Castle did not give the pipeline company prior notice of Moss's activities, that Moss had been given inaccurate information concerning the location of the pipeline, and that the accident site was just outside of the right-of-way and was not edged by trees. Black Castle maintains that the secretary is relying on inaccurate and irrelevant information, and that Moss was given accurate information concerning the location of the pipeline in his work area. Moreover, Black Castle maintains that the evidence and photographs of the accident scene show the bulldozer within the right-of-way that ran along the ridge and had a line of trees standing on either side. The secretary maintains that Moss told Vera that he was concerned about getting too close to the pipeline, and that Vera's response to stay 100 feet away from it was no response at all, given that Moss did not know the exact location of the pipeline. Black Castle maintains that during multiple discussions and meetings with his supervisors, Moss never expressed any doubt concerning the location of the pipeline. Moss's remarks to his co-worker did not convey the message to Black Castle management, and the only testimony contradicting the other witnesses' consistent testimony was deemed not credible by the judge. The secretary maintains that in finding that Black Castle had no reason to anticipate that Moss would go above the Clarion seam because it had nothing to do with his work assignment, the judge failed to consider the secretary's theories for possible reasons he went above the Clarion seam. Black Castle argues that it was not foreseeable that Moss would operate his bulldozer on the pipeline right of way. The judge specifically addressed the secretary's speculations regarding the possible reasons Moss would go above his assigned work area, and decided there was no evidence to support these theories. Black Castle further argues that there was no reason Moss would need to tram his dozer over 500 feet and 265 vertical feet uphill from his assigned work area to the pipeline right-of-way. In a separate response, Vera argues that the secretary's brief before the commission does not address the individual charge brought against Vera pursuant to Section 110C, apparently conceding that there was no individual liability. Vera further notes that during the 10 to 12 years Black Castle had been working in the vicinity of the pipeline, it was never cited by MSHA for not identifying the gas line on examination reports. Furthermore, Moss's assignment called for him to start his work at the closest point he should have been to the gas line in the Judy Lowe Gap area, which was marked by surveyors. And as he forged the access road to begin the bench, he would be moving away from the gas line. Moreover, Vera argues that the Secretary failed to prove a knowing violation of Section 77.1713A or any aggravated conduct by Vera. I would be happy to answer any questions.
Right away with the 110C, even if it hadn't been kicked off, I don't see it. So I would affirm the judge. I find that there's implicitly there's no violation, obviously, there's no 110C. I just don't see a violation here. Concerning the violation itself, I'm tempted to just affirm the judge because his opinion seems logical and appears to be well supported by evidence. There are a couple of things that trouble me about the opinion. One is the fact that there isn't expressly a finding, and how do we deal with that as to whether the area where the accident occurred was part of an active work. Active workings is defined in the Secretary's regulations as a place where miners would normally work and travel. If he was not assigned to go there, there's no foreseeable reason for him to be there. I don't see how that falls within the definition of active working. The judge, however, doesn't specifically find that it is part of the active work. He makes an assumption. This is kind of awkward because it's easy to do something with a fine. We could look at it and say, as I might in this case, I don't see substantial evidence to support my conclusion that this was the act within the active work of the month. It was an area that was far away and hard to get to relatively. That didn't pertain to his work assignment. The Secretary makes much of the fact that this was a very experienced dozer operator. And one would expect the operator might, in that case, rely on the experience of the dozer operator to be able to grasp and anticipate and avoid a known topographical feature that was an area proximate to the mine. Pipeline that had been there a long time was generally marked and located, as these pipelines often are, along a ridge line, bounded by trees in a mowed area. But there are a couple of things that also bother me about the overall conclusion. Make me worry about just affirming the judge as he reached his conclusion. While the area in question was, I believe, within the right of way, and the evidence supports that finding, there are areas where the markings have been worn away, the vegetation has been trampled or run over by ATVs and other traffic to the point where it's not clearly distinguishable in all places from the surrounding topography. Trees have been cut down along the right way in some areas, and while the timber is still lying there, it does make it more difficult. And the markings are clear and prominent in some areas, less clear and less prominent in others. Were we to affirm the judge, I think it would be important for us to state in our opinion that even where there are immutable geographical or topographical features that could create a hazard happen to be encountered and which are understood by everyone as a clear and present danger. If something were to change, i.e. if the markings were to be worn away, or if the mining operation were to change its configuration so that the pipeline might lie clearly within the active working, then that is a factor that I believe would have to be noted on an inspection for hazards. And it's important to not become complacent about things that are dangerous simply because they're always there. If this were, for example, a cliff, and everybody knew with a cliff, and the operator was certain that everyone should stay away from the cliff, there was a roadway constructed, if there were a fork in the road leading up to the cliff, it'd be important to put a sign up. And if there weren't a sign upon construction, whoever inspected ought to make note of that, make sure a sign got put up. This is a similar or analogous situation. In that regard, this is something that we've discussed with council indirectly among ourselves. And it seems to me that it would be better for us to conclude that this was not active work to the mine, not only because I believe that's what the evidence suggests, but because in addition to the fact that perhaps there were areas that were not as well marked as they might have been, that there might have been a possibility of confusion somewhere, although not confusion that would have led him up to there. In addition to that, I have to wonder a little bit, so hard to get that far away from where he was supposed to be, why he got there. And while I would agree there doesn't seem to be any actual evidence supporting this secretary's theory, which might be viewed as speculation, the fact remains that as a circumstance and as a piece of circumstantial evidence, it's something that doesn't make any sense. I'm not sure that I'm completely comfortable and supportive of the judge's dismissal of the secretary's theories in that regard. Although I think on balance, were I required to make a decision, I would say his decision is supported by substantial evidence. All the witnesses, except one, seem to indicate location of the pipeline was communicated to Mr. Moss. I don't believe it's material necessary to communicate exactly where it was. Where something is bounded and marked, if you tell them to stay 100 feet away from where it is, you can assume staying away from the right of way by 100 feet or even maybe 70 or 80 feet. Would put you in a zone of safety. I think that the fact that they went out there at least once, probably twice, to discuss this with Mr. Moss, and where the location in general was, I don't think that it's something that he would have been capable of figuring out based on the general run of the pipeline, the markings, particularly the area where he was most likely to come closest to it, which were prominent and well marked, and interpolation of the other features that delineated where the pipeline was. I don't believe it was unreasonable under those circumstances for the operator to consider his experience and to believe that it had appropriately addressed the situation. In terms of what this condition was, I therefore don't think it was a hazard in the definition of the standard, even if it were within the active workings of the mine. But as I said, I would prefer to resolve this on the fact that I don't believe that any evidence supports this being the area where the tragedy occurred, being in the active area, the active workings of the mine. It's contrary. Thank you.
Okay.
also hear from Commissioner Nakamura.
That was certainly a tragic case with tragic consequences. And I think from what you heard from, what I heard from Commissioner Young, a troubling one, and looking at the evidence and testimony. Of course, you know, Mr. Moss, who wasn't there to testify to what happened. And I think the judge even concluded his decision by saying no one knows, you know, how this tragic accident occurred. So I can see the but I haven't decided yet whether this case can be decided on whether this particular area where the accident occurred was part of the active workings or active mining where it occurred. As Commissioner Young stated, the judge just for purpose discussed it, but for purposes of this case just assumed that it was, and he didn't make that decision. And therefore, the issue wasn't adequately briefed by the parties. And I think that's still something that I need to think about as to whether or not the case can be decided on that basis. With respect to whether the particular provision was violated, I'm inclined to affirm the judge on the basis that the gas line was a structure of a permanent nature, and whose location was reasonably well established and known to the miners. The problem we have is that I think Anya, as you pointed out to me, there was no standard as far as how this particular gas line should be marked under the MSHA regulations. If there had been, perhaps there'd been a clearer violation of that particular standard, but there isn't one, and so they, found one that was, arguably violated, and that is the daily inspection of 77.1713A. There was this right of way. It had markings. The miners seemed to know, the general vicinity where it was, and there was actually. Also, and I'm not sure how the significance of this, but there was actually a miner on a hill on the other side who could see Mr. Moss working. And he saw Moss up there near or above, I think, the gas line coming down. And he could see, at least according to his testimony, he could see where the gas line was from way across the way. I don't know if there was an actual distance ever estimated for how far away he was. But he said that when he saw him up, this is Mr. Woodard, I think it was, when he saw him coming down, he was 75 yards. I think he said 75 feet from the gas line. So it at least from afar, it was designated well enough that he could see it. I don't know if this is one of those situations where if you're in the middle of something, you can't see it, but somebody from far away can. I don't think from the transcript, though, that was ever really explored in the testimony. I guess our job from at this this level is to just determine whether there's substantial evidence to support the judge's findings, whether we like the decision or not. It's not our job to reweigh the evidence. And I think there's substantial evidence that supports the judge's finding that the location of the gas pipeline was reasonably established, well established by the right-of-way, by the trees, and was known to the miners. So at this point, I'm inclined to affirm the judge on that basis. But reserve, I'll be thinking about the whether this is accurate.
Thank you, Commissioner McNamara. This was a horrible accident, and but yet, in the end, we have to consider that the operator was cited for violating a particular regulation, and the judge concluded that they had failed to prove that the violation of that regulation occurred. Now, when I look at the regulation, they were cited for regulation that requires that at least once each shift you have to inspect each active working area in each active surface installation, and then you inspect them for hazardous conditions. And then if you identify hazardous conditions, you have to report them and take corrective action. So there are requirements in place, and when you start to break it down, now the first requirement is when you conduct your inspection to determine the hazardous area, what area are you covering? You're required to cover the active working area. Now apparently this is not spelled out in a regulation. What does this mean, active working area? There is a definition when it comes to surface areas of an underground coal mine. There is a reference to active workings, and that's described as areas where miners normally work or travel. In this case, the secretary, not in her argument to us, understandably, because the judge assumed this would be in the active working area, the secretary proposed to the judge that active working area should be interpreted broadly enough to encompass all areas where it is reasonably foreseeable by the mine operator that miners will be working or traveling while carrying out their work-related tasks. So I have spent a lot of time really, you know, thinking about this and wrestling with this part of the regulation, because to me the second requirement is there a hazard. If this area where the accident occurred is considered within the active workings, I don't think I can reasonably conclude that there was not a hazard. And a situation where a bulldozer operator can come into contact with a gas line is a hazard. The company recognizes that themselves. The area in the Judy Lowe Gap, they sent surveyors out who were there. While Mr. Moss was over in his section, they sent surveyors out to identify exactly where the pipeline was and to put, I don't know what it's called, pin flags or something. So they put very extensive markings along that Judy Gap area. That was going to be an area where people were going to be much closer, in close proximity to that pipeline. The company recognized that. They weren't going to just leave whatever markings right of way, however that pipeline, you know, was out there identified in a general matter. And they admitted that at the hearing that Mr. Markham said, I was taking every precaution for the other crews or other men that would be coming into that area. In my mind, if you have a dangerous situation like a pipeline that could be ruptured, Mr. Moss, I mean, he, unless you believed he was suicidal, was trying to avoid the pipeline. There's conflicting information about exactly what was said in CB communications. that morning, but even under the judge's credibility determinations, Mr. Moss was at least, even under the operator's version, saying, how far away am I supposed to stay from the pipeline? And they said 100 feet. It didn't sound like, you know, he was asking so he could aim for it. So one had to conclude he was trying to avoid it, and yet he came into contact with it. How can you conclude that the pipeline was adequately marked in that area of the accident? The second, you know, no matter, the pipeline is on there, correct? I don't know how long this pipeline goes. It's many miles.
32.
It's 32 miles. The testimony that was presented, I believe, was in a general format for the most part. Here's how we designate the pipeline. There's a right-of-way, there's a muddy path, there's some paint, there's some carcinite markers, sometimes there's some flags. And when we sent these people in to cut down the trees so we could mine this area, we did tell them to leave a row of standing trees on either side. But I don't think you can conclude from that, like in every section of that pipeline, there's all this adequate marking. Clearly there was not, because Mr. Moss, you know, came into contact with this pipeline. And so the secretary, in fact, put evidence into the record that in the spot where the accident occurred, as you pointed out, honey, there, the one particular marking was a couple of hundred feet away. There were not trees there right at this point of the accident. And in terms of even recognizing the right-of-way, the point where the accident occurred was on the edge of the right-of-way. It wasn't really even in the right-of-way, so he wasn't actually in. So I feel like an area, a pipeline, in a situation where a bulldozer operator is, you know, that's not adequately marked so that someone could contact it, that's a hazard. So I focused more on, but wait a minute, they're being cited for the fact that they did not inspect this area and recognize this hazard. They did not go in there and inspect this part of the pipeline and see how hazardous was it when people, you know, was it marked properly. And, you know, the secretary, in her proposed definition here, is saying that it has to be the area, when you're deciding what you're going to cover in your on-shift area, it's going to be the area that it's reasonably foreseeable by the miner operator that miners will be working or traveling while carrying out their work-related tasks. And I don't believe that the secretary carried their burden in this part. Apparently, Mr. Moss, he was quite a distance from where he was supposed to be. So, the question was it reasonably foreseeable for Black Castle to include where he was in their on-shift inspection? Now, granted, when you have a dangerous condition on mine property, you need to kind of give it a wide berth. I mean, you're not maybe going to just say, well, as long as you are closely in your area, you know, you won't come into danger. But, you know, if you step 20 feet out of here, you know, you're going to have a risk. No. I mean, the greater the danger, I think you are going to have to step back and have a wide berth. But he tramped 500 feet from where he was supposed to be, and also at a different elevation. And, you know, I kind of thought to myself, 100 feet, that's a lot from where he's supposed to be. I don't know if you could say that Black Castle would have reasonably foreseen he would be there. You know, even when you have regulations, unfortunately, we don't have one that says to an operator, here's what you have to do when you have a pipeline on your surface mine. There are regulations that say, here's what you do when you have a gas well or something in your underground mine. You make a barrier like 300 feet wide around it. So really there, you don't have to worry about foreseeable who's going to work where. It's just, you're going to protect anybody from coming into that proximity. You know, even if they do come into proximity, there's going to be a barrier 300 feet around. when you have an abandoned or adjacent mine in your underground mine, another dangerous situation that you might actually accidentally encounter, there are regs that say what to do there. You start drilling, you know, 200 feet, when you think you're 200 feet away, you start test drilling so you don't accidentally come into contact with this dangerous situation. Here, we don't have something that says to the operator, here's what you do to your gas well. You know, you make sure there's like flag planted every 2 feet or something, you know. And so really the reg that, the only reg we're looking at is, did you examine for hazardous conditions in the area that was reasonably foreseeable where miners would be assigned to work and travel? And the secretary has suggested and put, you know, evidence in. Continue to look at that a little closer. But as suggesting as to why somebody might have gone where Mr. Moss went to do some work-related activity. But I, you know, it seems speculative. The operator's testimony, you know, they testified, they really didn't have any reason to think he would be there. My position, you know, in this matter now, I think, is that I would affirm the judge and result, because the judge and result said that they did not violate, the secretary did not prove a violation of this particular regulation. But I would do it on different grounds. I would say that under the secretary's own proposed construction of the phrase active working area, and I'm not sure I don't think I want to get into it. Yes, this is the right construction. You know, in this case, I don't think I have to. Because there is some dispute about whether the operator points to another ruling of, you know, under the commission where they construed it a little bit differently. But even under this construction that they are proposing to us, they haven't proved that that first threshold requirement that the operator should have foreseen Mr. Moss was in this area, should have included this area in their on-shift inspection. Really, you don't have to go to the second prompt of if they had included it, would they have, you know, should they have determined there was a hazard there? But I think that, so I'm not sure I would even, I don't know, I haven't thinking of that more, you know, that the decision should or shouldn't address that. I mean, in my mind, it seems that it would be a hazard.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
Well, the reasonable foreseeability construction, that comes from where?
The secretary's post-hearing brief to the judge on page 29.
Okay, so they didn't, yeah, because that issue wasn't before us, they
right.
Posited that to us.
They didn't posit it to us.
That aren't this level. And then you were saying, though, that we don't necessarily, in order to decide that issue, we don't necessarily have to adopt that construction.
I was wondering about that, because I don't know if we have to say we're adopting it from now on, you know, we're approving it, I mean, do we? Because I'm thinking to myself, if I said, all right, let me just take your proposed interpretation to this case, it is right, but you're positive to me, you don't meet it. Whether this is the correct construction that I would agree and approve it for how you should apply this reg for all times, I don't know. I'm still thinking about that. Should we? address it. I mean, there's a different, there's a case that the operator cites too that talks about a different construction that talks about that the active working area is limited to the actual mining pit. Extraction of coal. You know, it construed it a little differently. So we would get into the situation of are we, you know, what are we doing with that prior one and how does that relate to this? Is it different? So I wasn't sure. I had to really say, oh, yeah, this is the correct construction. But I could say, all right, you've proposed that I use this construction in evaluating your enforcement action that you took here. Okay. If I do that, you haven't demonstrated the foreseeability enough. So that was where I was looking at this.
I have this. I think the secretary is someone I wanted to make the same mistake. ALJ and Central Ohio Coal Company case where the judge said, well, now active work does not in 77.2, right? That doesn't apply. It's not the definition that applies to 1713A, which is the inspection standard. If you're talking about the pit, he's finding that 77.2A doesn't apply. And I think the judge, by implication, correctly rejects that. 77.2A is an aerial definition that refers to any place. So when the secretary comes in, if she wants to try to enlarge a defined term that's been subject to notice and comment of rulemaking, I'm not agreeing with that. But I would agree in this case that even if she were to have the benefit of the enlarged term she seeks to impose on us, it wouldn't matter because it's not reasonably foreseeable that it could go up. I think when you're looking at what normally work and travel does is it provides necessary guidance to the operator where the inspection needs to begin and end, that they don't need to inspect beyond the working area where miners are normally going to be working and travel for hazards. And, you know, on a clear day, you can proceed forever. The secretary is going to say, well, reasonably foreseeable means that you should have anticipated this. Because somebody did it, obviously it was something that could have happened. Therefore, I don't see that as being an appropriate way to start deviating and imposing or injecting some elasticity into defined terms in the regulations. So I don't think that's a reasonable expansion. As I said, I think she's making the same mistake the ALJ made in saying it's not 77.2A. No, it is, because that's a defined term, and it can't mean anything else because it refers to a place. A place is the same thing as an area. But I'm okay with saying it doesn't matter. Even if we adopt your definition and deferring that for when it has material bearing on the case, I don't think it would in this case. Because I think he was so far out of the zone that it wasn't even reasonably.
That's funny because the foreseeability standard is possibly allowing operators to constrain a particular area.
That's what I was going to say. I'm not sure that it was brought. Your concern is that the secretary is proposing an expansion. Commissioner Nakamura and I didn't see it that way. In fact, I thought it was almost narrow.
Well, I don't know why she would do that. And to me, it's where you get these, you know, this is kind of the old Paul Scrappy and post hoc. Well, this is what happened, and therefore, you should have seen this coming.
Well,
explosion.
Let me just ask you something. I'm not sure there's really much different. I mean, I didn't view it. I thought they were talking about the application of, you know, the term active workings. And that's been defined to mean any place in the coal mine where miners are normally required to work or travel. If you, I'm not sure that that's, and then this is a different phrase, active working place, but the foreseeability aspect, I mean, you wouldn't, it would have to be, you know, they would, but if it's foreseeable, normal, where they're normally required to work or travel, I mean, that makes it
I guess you could have a foreseeable
that they're going to be in that area, and that's why you're, you need to expect it.
If you could have a hypothetical, you'd have a case where the operator said, all right, get down to the pit and take this road. Don't take any other road. This road is marked, it's safe, it's got berms. This is how you get down. But they know that there's this trail that everybody takes. Everybody takes it, and they don't do anything about it. And then one day, you know, there's this giant sinkhole in the middle of the trail. And they're not inspecting that area, and the truck goes down there and falls in the sinkhole, and somebody dies. They say, well, that's not where they normally work to travel. We have a road. We tell them this is what you're supposed to do. But is it reasonably foreseeable that someone would take this much easier shortcut that everybody knows about? Sure. And you could look at that and say, well, that's what that means. Now, you could also say, using the correct definition, the fact that you're prohibited from doing something, if everybody does it, you know it, that's what they normally do. That's what normal means, the norm, the standard. What did they do? I mean, if it's easier or quicker, it's not the shortcut, it's the way. So.
I mean, also, you have the issue that's in this case, what's the matter? Because there was a virgin, you know, there's a virgin area, and he was constructing the access road and the cropping and the drill bench. So, you know, they were making the normal, so to speak.
He was just
creating it. So, how does the, you know, if you're deciding where to do your on shift, the miners normally work? People, you know, I don't know, that might be not so helpful. Maybe that's why the secretary proposed this construction of the phrase active working place. There had to be some perimeter drawn about where you do your on shifts. Clearly, the regulation doesn't say, you know, you don't inspect your whole mine every pre shift and every on shift, you know, even an underground mine. If there was a dangerous area, but it was over in this abandoned part of the mine, and you don't include that in your on shift pre-shift, so something has to be drawn. So this is how they drew it.
I mean, to the extent she's saying what normally required means, she says that means it's reasonably foreseeable that they would go there. I don't think there's anything proper with that, but it seems from the brief that what she's actually saying. Oh no, it's not this definition. There's a different definition of law. I don't think there's a different definition. You can explain and interpret the definition if it's not clear. And normally required, as you just pointed out, there might be situations where it's not clear. And this might be one of them. But I think it's this definition, 77.2.
What do you mean by this definition? You think that applies?
Yes. That's the binding definition. What it means is could be open to discussion and interpretation. But whether this is the definition that applies under 77.17.13, I don't think that should be. To me, it doesn't seem a debatable proposition. This definition is the one you should use.
Yeah.
It was wrong for Senator Lyle Cole for the judge to apply a different definition. It was wrong for the secretary to apply a different. It's not wrong for her to explain what she thinks. It's not clear.
So you're basically saying active working area is the same as active working.
Yes. Active working area refers to the place that's talked about in 77.2a. That's the place. It's a place.
And based on that definition, you can still find that this is not an active working area.
Correct. And in fact, I would find that based on what I can't see any reason why you would find it. There's just not. There's nothing in the evidence that suggests a reason why.
Hours, like
Hold it.
Well, nothing, but it's expected. It's actually, I did put some testimony on about, you know, why someone might go up and remove trees in preparation for not having something fall over the high wall, but.
There's nothing to corroborate that theory in the evidence of the record, except, well, this is why he might have done it. You know, you could just as well say, and I'm not imputing him or saying this, that he was on, that he became disoriented for some reason, and that he got lost. And it's not unreasonable for me to think that as you described, Commissioner Nackler, that if you were in certain areas on that pipeline, depending on which way you were looking, you might not know you were in the right way. And to that point, I'm not sure that it's our place to do so. But pipelines across service lines likely get more common. And it might behoove the Secretary, and I don't know whether we want to suggest this, that this is an area where a standard for marking pipeline might be advisable. How you deal with that feature is something that you ought to consider for the moment.
Well, do we have enough, or do we require like further deliberation, or is, I mean, it doesn't, obviously Anya knows where to find us and talk to us. I don't know. I guess what I'm getting to is whether it makes sense for Anya to draft a decision a certain way. Maybe that would be helpful, even while you're still considering, even if you haven't formally concluded exactly how many points or, you know, which way we would go. It's helpful to have a little bit of a discussion in this forum, since we obviously can't talk one-on-one with each other except after noticing a meeting. But at a minimum, I mean, I guess the most concise, and it can be expanded out from there, is to draft something that would say that we would affirm and result. It's the regulation, you know, requires that the inspection be conducted. The hazards, sort of doing it the opposite of what the judge should, even assuming if there were a hazardous condition, it didn't come within the area required to be inspected for the on-ship, the active working area, because it wasn't foreseeable he would be there, something like along that effect.
I think that makes sense to me, to draft it that way, where it's like it's not an active work here, but even if it was, here's the analysis for the judge's report. If that's okay with the commission.
Wait, the second part of what you said, even if it was an
active work here? Even if it were an
active work here. Oh, to do both, to then say, even if it were an active working area, then the separate, because you would say, even if it were in the active working area, it didn't meet the second one, that it would have been a hazard that would have had to be noticed.
Correct, and I think I'm in the group with Commissioner Nackler.
Oh, and I'm not, so that's true. Okay,
so what
you could, yes, you should draft it.
Then you would have both of the necessary opinions if it's drafted that way.
That's true.
I still have to come to the decision.
Actually, that's not fair. It's not really exactly fair to you, because you have two of the three necessary opinions, but not yours. This wouldn't be drafted.
No. Well,
If you would, you would not be part of an opinion that said, even if
if it were in the active working, it would not be a hazard. Right. So I would be like concurring, and not concurring, dissenting on that. But it could still be written that way, and I guess here's what we'll have to have the help of OGC, counsel and Anya to figure out, just how that format is. But at least for think when I'm hearing, I think it's regretted, I think the young said that it didn't come within the active working area. But even if it did, it was not a hazard, because that seems to be how the majority.
Yeah, I agree with what you expressed.
There's a majority
expressed
either way. Yeah.
In your remarks. So.
Because there's a majority for each of those separate. People might have to do something separately from that. That's how it winds up. Okay.
Yeah, and for active working area, are we taking 77.2? Are we taking the secretary's definition and her post-hearing brief, or are we doing both?
I'm okay with just with saying the secretary proposed this in her brief before the judge. The issue wasn't brought to us directly, so it wasn't briefed before us. Even if we apply the definition by the secretary, ... I'm okay with doing that one.
Yeah, okay.
And not deciding the issue.
Not deciding whether it's the same as this or not, or whether they should have used the other one.
Whatever we do, I think we should reference both definitions. It doesn't matter which one we apply. Because I don't think it matters to any of us which definition we apply.
Right, in this case.
In this case.
I think the foreseeable is the more. It's still how the arguments were framed, that we didn't know we could be there, that the term normal. But, like you said, we don't have, we can draft it so that it's.
We don't have to decide which definition applies,
right.
In other words, right?
I don't think my view would change, even if I was staring at 388, I guess it's now. The active workings 77.2A. I don't think my conclusion would change if I come.
Mine wouldn't change if I adopted the secretary's definition.
Right. So,
we're ending the conference call.